Thank you. I'm Tony Curry, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Hello, everybody. It is such a thrill. I cannot tell you what an honor it is for me to be here and to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you who are my peers and who have grown up with me and who've watched me grow up. Although that growing up started at the tender age of 37, I still grew up into an adult from the age of 37. And it's just a joy to be here. I was just telling John, this committee really knows how to throw a party, and I appreciate so much being invited to be here with you. They're just some of my favorite people in all the world here. I wish I could name every name, but they're just some people who were here from the very beginning with me, like Conway is out there. And Conway was the very first speaker I ever heard at the Biscayne Room. And I had on a red and white polka dot cocktail dress. It never occurred to me that I might be a tad overdressed. And Joe and John were two of the first speakers I ever heard. And Frankie, my dear friend Frankie down here on the front row, was one of the first speakers I ever heard. And actually, the first talk I ever made was for Frankie's home group, the Tri-City group. And I was so nervous that I shook all the way through it. I coughed all the way through it. And smoked cigarettes from the podium all the way through. So embarrassing to me to think about that. And after that talk, Frankie came up and took my hand, and he did not say, "Well, Tony, I appreciate your message," or, "Tony, that was a nice little talk." He just said, "Well, honey, just hang in there." And Frankie, I did. And it's been 23 years. I hung in there. It's been 23 years. And I appreciate your having me here. And you've invited me to share several times with you in this state. And I appreciate it so much because there were times when I was not only not invited back, I was asked to leave places, you know. I'm interested that Rusty introduces me as a lady. And, you know, I can remember the night that I was arrested for a DUI, and I said to the policeman, "You cannot take me to jail, I'm a lady." And he said, "Well, lady, you are going to jail." So I've been asked to leave places, and you keep inviting me back, and I'm so honored. My ex-husband tells me that I was such an embarrassment to him when we were married, and he was a tarpon tournament fisherman. And he was invited to this invitational tarpon tournament every year in Isla Mirada, Florida. So we spent really a lot of our years in Isla Mirada when we were married. And he was in the social whirl of this tarpon tournament. And he always said, "Now, listen, you know, there's some very important people here, and I want you to help me impress these people." And there was one particular man who was the president of a Coca-Cola company in another city. And he said, "Now, you know, I want you to help me impress this man because he's such an important guy." And I said, "Okay." So I did. I helped him impress him. That night when I leaned over to kiss him, my wig fell off in his dinner plate. So I was invited to leave Isla Mirada, Florida. And I have never seen Isla Mirada since. I was never invited back. I was just such an embarrassment. So... well, my instructions are that I'm supposed to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I can only tell you that I come from a family where there is just almost 100%, perhaps 100% alcoholism. Everybody who ever took a swallow of alcohol became alcoholic. And I don't know how in the world I thought that I would be able to change those odds. I don't know what was possessing my thinking when I thought at the age of 21, when I started drinking after I married, drinking with other young couples that we ran around with, I don't know how I thought that I would beat those odds. But I had not looked like an alcoholic in the beginning. I grew up in right out there where Frankie's home group is. I grew up in College Park, and I was an honor graduate of the 1956 graduating class. I was president of the Honor Society. I was president of the course, president of the bank, on the student council, homecoming court, everything. I was involved in everything. I certainly didn't look like somebody who was destined to be lying down drunk a lot. And actually, you did guess it. You sadistic people out there who are trying to add up those numbers, it is the big 60. And my children are just as sadistic as you are trying to add up those numbers. On my birthday last month, they put 400 tombstones in my front yard that said, rest in peace, over the hill, and a big marquee that said, here in this graveyard lies the youth of Tony Curry. Right out. So they're just as sadistic as all of you who are trying to count up those numbers. But I did start drinking, and I was so terrified, actually, that I would turn out to be like my father or like any of the other alcoholics in the family, that I rigidly controlled my drinking for about 10 years. I managed to look like a social drinker. Now, I only know now, as Dr. John said, that I was just controlling it. I was not actually a social drinker. I just managed to look like one. But along the way, my husband and I were putting ourselves through school and beginning our careers. He in real estate, and I was a school teacher. And after about 5 years, I began to have children in a completely repetitive fashion, one after the other. I had 3 babies in 3 years. And so when those children were really young, I decided I wanted to stop smoking cigarettes. And I only tell you about that. I just didn't want to be a smoking mother, and that's... The value of this story is only that it's when my problem with addiction began, because I went nuts. I just absolutely was a nervous wreck when I quit smoking, and I'll bet some of you in here know exactly what that feels like. And so I went to doctors, and they said, well, honey, it's your nerve. So if you'll just take these little pills, you'll be all right. So I took those little pills, and I took, what all did I take? Valium and Librium and... Senequan, Elevil. The mic's off? Is it on? I hear an echo. It must be back on. I took Elevil and Trivil, Senequan. I took Nembutal, Tuinol, Secanol, anything at all. And for the next year, I was completely addicted to those medications that I was being prescribed. And the doctors just kept saying, well, honey, you know, there are 1,000 medications. I kept saying, I don't like the way these make me feel. The psychiatrist said, honey, there are 1,000 medications. We just need to find the one that will be the right one for you. So we kept switching and trying all that whole year. And I was abusing and addicted to just about everything that I was prescribed. You know, if I have a theme in my story, it is that God does for me what I cannot do for myself. That's certainly one part of my story. And another part of my story is that God just keeps bringing me for 23 years full circle to places of healing. And this medication little binge that I was on is a part of the full circles. You know, that fellow who said, you know, there are any number of medications, you just have to find the right one. And every week I'd go see him, and he would fold his arms and say, hello, Mrs. Curry, and that's about all he'd say. Then an hour later, after I'm pouring my heart out, he'd say, goodbye, Mrs. Curry, time's up, sorry, see you next week. So I finally, after a year, said, I just can't do this anymore. So I said one day, Dr. So-and-so, I can't do this anymore, and I'm not going to be back. And he said, well, I'm just sorry, Mrs. Curry, that you did not use your time more wisely. That was his goodbye to me as I walked out the door. Well, 15 years later, I was referred somebody in my office by a doctor in Washington, and that person turned out to be this doctor's relative. So God brought me full circle and got me to be the one to evaluate the psychiatrist's relative. The psychiatrist wasn't asked to evaluate him. So there was a little full circle. And this psychiatrist also put me in the psychiatric unit at Emory Hospital. And there they told me that I was not an alcoholic. And I said, you know, why do you think I'm not an alcoholic? I was just drunk and half dead by the time I got there. And they said, because you're too young. I was 31, and you haven't had the problem long enough. And so I don't know how long you have to be half dead before you get diagnosed with alcoholism. But they said I was not an alcoholic, I should go home and drink, and so I bought a half gallon of wine on the way home from the hospital and proceeded to try to prove them correct that I was not an alcoholic. They referred me to a psychiatrist to see 3 times a week, and this psychiatrist thought that I had a Thorazine deficiency. So So he prescribed massive doses of Thorazine for me and then Cogentin to counter the effects of the Thorazine. And so I don't know if any of you in here have ever taken Thorazine before. You look very interesting on Thorazine. I mean, you know how when we walk, if we're halfway normal, we kind of meander and we swing our arms. Well, you can't do that on Thorazine. You shuffle. You hold your arms straight down by your side and you shuffle. This is the way you walk. So for the next year, I shuffled out of bed in the morning and shuffled off to carpool and shuffled to cook and shuffled to do this and that and the other. And this psychiatrist said another thing to me, too. He said that I was so mentally ill and that I was so emotionally sick that I would never be able to live a day of my life without Thorazine. Now, I'm still waiting for that full circle, because I haven't had a Thorazine in 23 years. In fact, it's been 25 years probably. And you know, I'd like for him to follow me around. I'd like for him to go work out with me 2 hours every other day. I'll bet you he couldn't keep up with me. And so I want that full circle to come around sooner or later. But it was a terrible time. You know, I can joke about it now because I've healed a lot from it and because God has brought me full circle. But it was a terrible time. It was a time of despair. It was a time when I could not take care of my children. I couldn't always get them to school. I couldn't do the things that they needed me to do. After I got sober, I used to worry about whether I had ever abused my children or not. And I asked my children, was I ever mean to you? And they said, oh, Mom, no, you were always so sweet. You just slept a lot. Well, that's abuse. That is abuse. I was not available to them when they needed me. And so that's a part of the despair of this disease that, you know, the only thing I ever wanted to be in my life was a mother. I never cared about a career, never cared about anything but being a mother. And the one thing I wanted to do, I was not doing well. And so it was a time of terrible despair, terrible heartache, terrible addiction. I was now drinking more, and I will tell you about a little bit about the drinking and how those patterns changed as well. You know, when I threw away the pills after about a year and continued to drink, within a matter of days I was drinking alcoholically, and I never drank any other way after that time. And my husband was sick of it. I was an embarrassment to him. He didn't want to have anything to do with me. He just wanted me to get my act together and stop embarrassing him. And so he hired a private detective to follow me and tapped my telephone. But he did not need Al-Anon. I want to clarify that. You know, he did not need Al-Anon. But the pattern of my drinking changed dramatically when I found out there was a private detective following me and my telephone was tapped. I was afraid to go to the liquor store because I knew that those efforts were designed to take my children away from me. So I was afraid to go to the liquor store. Couldn't be seen. Tried to stop drinking. Could not stop drinking, Angela. Just as hard as I tried, I could not stop. And one day I was in the drugstore and I noticed that Micron mouthwash had 18% alcohol. I thought, well, now I wonder if this is the same kind of alcohol, if it works. Well, I took it home and I drank it and it worked, and I was right back up there buying another bottle of Micron mouthwash. Then I began to read labels, and I read Scope had 18%, Cepacol had 18%, Listerine had 18%. I had the sweetest breath in town for the longest time. And then I found vanilla extract. It had 68%, for goodness sakes. Lemon extract had 84%. And I would have drunk whatever I thought had alcohol in it. And the worst part of it all, deluding myself that I was not really drinking, because it did not come in a liquor bottle, a beer bottle, or a wine bottle. So I could delude myself that I'm okay. I hid my vanilla flavoring in a shoebox in my walk-in closet. My husband had bought us this beautiful, huge home on 38 acres of land. It was so pretty. And I had a big walk-in closet. So I was one of the original closet drinkers. And I had my vanilla flavoring up there in the shoebox. And my husband would say, you're an alcoholic. I want you to get your act together. And I'd say, I am not an alcoholic. I am a college graduate. I've been a school teacher. Look at this big, beautiful home I live in. The alcoholics are down on Skid Row drinking vanilla flavoring out of the paper bag. And after all, mine is in my closet, in my third-story bedroom. So obviously things were not going well in that marriage, and that marriage was not to last. And if ever I thought that I was in trouble as a married alcoholic, I had no earthly idea how much trouble I could get into as a single female alcoholic in Atlanta, Georgia. But it says our stories disclose in a general way. So don't get your hopes up that you are going to get the delicious tales of that time in my life. The worst part about it was that my children and I had moved into a condo. I was allowed to keep my children. The one thing I feared most was losing my children. I was allowed to keep those. And I will have to say, I want to give credit to my ex, who is, by the way, a very good friend of mine today. We tried to kill each other for years, and now we are very good friends. So in case I forget to say that later, I need to say that now. But he knew that I was a good mother when I was sober. He knew that. He said it often, and he tried in every way to help me keep my children. So the worst part of that year was that we were living there, and they were the parents in the household, and I was the child. And I've told them many times that they did a very good job because I turned out all right. But they had all the responsibility. I'm the one who was lying there drunk most of the time, day in, day out. And they were worried. They had to get transportation from other people sometimes. They had to cook for themselves. My son, the oldest child in the family, as you would figure out, is the most responsible human being I have ever met in my life to this day. He is so responsible. And he was trained well. He had to be responsible from the time he was a little tyke. He never got to be a child. That's one of the horrors of alcoholism. My oldest son in particular never got to be a little boy. So it was terrible for them. You know, I can remember one night when he followed me all the way down 3 or 4 flights of stairs begging me not to go out and get a drink. And I had to go. I had to go. And he was still standing on the little porch when I came back. I have no idea how long later. He was ashen white, you know, and he had been there by himself at midnight taking care of his two little sisters. And then another time during that year, I was trying so hard. If you could stop drinking and control it, I would have done it. If it were possible, I would have done it. I tried so hard to control it. You know, I would decide, well, I'm only going to drink when I go out. While the kids are still away, I will go up to the Lark and the Dove, and I'll have a couple of drinks, and then I'll come home. So the first day I went into the Lark and the Dove, and there were 3 or 4 men sitting around. I'd never been in a bar by myself in my life. Scared me to death. I didn't know how to act in a bar. So I said, I'll have a double vodka martini to go, please. And so then I was going to go home and not drink anymore. But then within a few days, I'd get a double to go there, and then I'd go next door to Steak and Ale, get a double to go there, and then a week later, I'm down at the Plank House getting my third double to go, and then a month later, I'm buying a pint on the way home, and that was that effort to control it. You know, when I got the DUI and went to hear Conway speak because the judge told me to go to AA, you know, I was trying real hard then not to drink. I started taking antabuse, and I drank on top of antabuse and taught myself how to drink on top of antabuse. The insanity of this disease. That you take antabuse and then teach yourself how to drink on it. It's just unbelievable what we do. And yet at the time it seems to make perfect sense to us. So I tried so hard to control it. One time when I drank on antabuse, I fell and cracked my head open. And my son had the responsibility, the presence of mind, to call an ambulance, a doctor, my parents, to help me. And my son was 8 years old. And my daughters had to drag Mom to a bed, mop the blood up off the white carpeting, and my daughters were 5 and 6 years old. And that's alcoholism. I wish it was just me bending my elbow and hurting me, but it's all the people who love me that I hurt. That is what alcoholism is all about. And my children were taken away from me that day. I lost full and permanent custody of my children that day, and I knew that this was to be a permanent situation, and it just was the most devastating thing I had ever experienced in my life. I did not believe I could live through it, and there are people sitting here today who can tell you a lot more about my story during that period of time than I can, because it's a haze to me. I can scarcely remember the days. I do know that Christmas Day that year, I was supposed to have my children. Although they weren't living with me, they were going to spend Christmas Day with me. Well, I couldn't get sober to shop. I couldn't get sober to buy the groceries. So I went to Plan B. I called my parents and said, I'm just not going to be able to put it together. We'll have to come out to your house for Christmas dinner, and I'll come out there. Well, I woke up on Christmas Day. It was 7. The clock said 7. It was a little bit light outside the window. I decided to have another drink so I'd feel a little bit better because I felt pretty rough having to go out there for Christmas dinner. I have another drink, close my eyes, open my eyes again. It's a little bit light outside. The clock said 7. Only the entire day had gone by. The entire Christmas Day was gone. And Plan C, I missed it. And that's what I hope I don't ever forget about this disease and where it takes me when I take a drink. I can't predict where I'm going and how much I'm going to drink, what my behavior will be. I can't predict it. And just hope I don't ever forget those awful times and know where I can go easily if I decide to drink again. Well, what happened? I'll tell you what happened. During that year that I bought that condo, my children were in a private school. And I was trying to buy a condo that was close to the school because in my drinking thinking, I had to drive over to that school. Don't get ahead of me now. I was trying to drive over to that school 4 times a day. So how do you stay drunk and have to get in your car and drive across town 4 times a day to either pick up or drop off children? So I wanted a condo close to the school. Well, I wound up buying a condo that was at least 10 miles further away than the house I was moving out of. I could not tell you why I bought that condo. But I lay there in that condo, off and on drunk, for the next year, which I've already described to you. And in the fall of that year, I noticed out my bedroom window the leaves were falling off the trees, and I could see through the limbs that they were building, this long, low building in my backyard. I thought, this is just the way a school looks. Long, low building. You know how they all look. How lucky can you be? I've moved out here in the middle of the boondocks, and they're building a school in my backyard. And I won't have to drive 4 times a day across town. I will have my children going right out the back door, walking to school. And then what will Mom do all day while they're in school? Mom will drink. Well, that building turned out to be Charter Peachford Hospital for the school. It's on page 84 of the big book. Says, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I believe God said to his angels, this woman is so sick. If we don't make it easy for her, she will never get sober. So let's just build a hospital in her backyard. She can crawl over there if she has to. And I just about did. I was admitted not long after Peachford opened. I was admitted at 7 a.m. On a Monday morning, as a matter of fact, in a long black evening dress that I'd had on for 4 days. And a wig that was a little crooked that I'd had on for 4 years. And Conway and the staff did not laugh at me. Or at least in front of me, you didn't laugh. I'll bet you they were doubled over in staff meeting that morning. And it never occurred to me that wearing a long black evening dress at 7 a.m. in the morning might be a tad overdressed. Well, I did not go there to get sober. I went there because I'd lost custody of my children, and I wanted for them to help me get medical control of myself so that I could get my children back. That was really all I wanted. But I left there 21 days later. And I wanted to stay sober, whether I ever got my children back or not. And what happened, in spite of the fact that I went into DTs on the second day and kicked Conway and the rest of the staff, thank goodness I came through treatment at a time when they did not say she's being obnoxious, let's administratively discharge her as uncooperative. which is what I see every day today in the field, all the time. Thank goodness this staff knew that I was in withdrawal. And they knew that, they were just like my children. You know, my children knew that I was not the person that turned up after I had been drinking alcohol. They knew that was not me. And this staff knew that I was in withdrawal. And they just loved me. And DTs, I'm out there on the courtyard kicking them all. And I will never forget one counselor named Tom just looked at me and said, "Now, don't you realize we're bigger than you are? Now just get your butt over there and get in that bed." And I got my butt over there and got in that bed. And they gave me paraldehyde. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember the old paraldehyde. It would have definitely been a drug of choice of mine if I'd known about it at the time. But they kept me sort of conked out for quite a number of days. And then when I came to, I still had my bag packed, going to leave every day because, you know, they didn't really know what they were doing. And each day I thought, well, I'll give them one more chance to try to get it right. But kept my bag packed every day. But then on the 21st day when they said, "Okay, Tony, you can go home," I could not leave. And I could see my back door from the front door of the hospital, and I could not leave. I was so terrified that my car would drive to a liquor store when I wanted to go somewhere else. I was so terrified I would not be able to control it. And I went home for a couple of hours, changed clothes, came back to the hospital, went to a meeting with the patients, went home and slept, came back at 8 or 9 o'clock the next morning, stayed there till midnight, went home, slept, came back at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And I created a little outpatient program for myself that I didn't have to pay for. And Conway and the staff never complained about it because they said they didn't dare let me leave. I was too sick for them to let me leave. So they just let me keep coming back. I have such gratitude for the beginning that I was able to have because it doesn't exist today. And, you know, we're going to have a little reunion Sunday with those people who were around in the mid-70s in that hospital where there was a magical treatment going on. It was just magic, and people were just getting sober everywhere. You know, we had that meeting on Sunday afternoon where there'd be 400 and 500 people there. There's a handful of people there today. I mean, it just was a magical time. It just was wonderful. Otherwise, I would never have gotten sober. But these people loved me unconditionally. I had not experienced that except from my children. They loved me unconditionally. And I wish I could tell you I stayed sober, but they told me very specifically things that I needed to do in my program. But when I got to be about 6 months, I decided that maybe those things applied to other people, but I was weller than other people, and so therefore I could have a relationship. And so I got into this little relationship when I was 6 months sober, and we both got drunk. And so I wound up having to go back through treatment at the Willing Way Hospital the following year, May 3rd, 1975, and I am very, very grateful to have been sober since that day. But it was not easy coming back. It was very, very difficult, you know. I no longer had parents who were supporting me. There certainly was no longer the wealthy husband who was taking care of me. My children were gone for good, and the walls of my condo just absolutely screamed at me, just screamed silence at me. It was a really, really hard time. I look back on it now, and I know that I was significantly depressed. But back in those days, they didn't just automatically put you on medication. They made you work through it. And I have a lot of gratitude for that as well. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I probably went to 190 meetings in 90 days. They told me to get a sponsor. I got 5 sponsors. And I don't recommend this now, but I needed every one of those sponsors, and they all agreed that I needed every one of them, too. My closest sponsors were a husband and wife team, and I worked with them every day. They lived next door to me, and we saw each other every day. We talked every day. They were old enough to be my parents, and they just reparented me, and they really taught me how to be a responsible human being. They taught me the program, and they taught me that my children were not responsible for my sobriety. I had always said, if you take my kids away, I'll never get sober. But they were taken away, and I was getting sober. And they were teaching me that my children are not responsible for my happiness and my sobriety. That my sobriety and my happiness is contingent on my spiritual condition on a daily basis. And they taught me a conscious contact with God. I will never forget the first time Jimmy talked to me about God in Peachford. I said, I don't want to hear that word. If there is a God, he took my children away from me, and I want nothing to do with that God. And Jimmy said, well, Tony, is your life unmanageable? Well, yes, my life is unmanageable. Then don't you think you better find a manager? And, you know, I have so much gratitude that he took me where I was and tried to lead me to a better place. He didn't try to make me do something I couldn't do that day, because I might have run away from him. I might have gone. But he just took me where I was and led me to a better place. And they taught me about a conscious contact with a God that I do not understand today. But I definitely have a conscious contact with a God that I don't understand. I can't tell you about him. I just know that I believe that there is a God that watches over me and that understands what I need, and who every day gives me what I need, and not always what I want, but it is definitely what I need. And as I began to grow in the program, God began to give me new opportunities. And my ex-mother-in-law began to call and say, Tony, you need to do something about your children. And I said, but Mama Curry, I can't do that. You know, I've gotten sober. You know, that's really the most important thing to me in my life, is to be sober. And what if I'm not meant to be a mother? What if I were to mess up again? What if I were to hurt these children again? You know, I just can't do it. And she kept calling me. And the maid who had worked for me all those years that I was married kept calling, Miss Tony, you got to do something about your children. And so all of these messages kept coming in. To make a long story short, my sponsors and I believed that for whatever reason, God was moving us to file for custody, and I did file for custody that year. It was very frightening because I was a recovering alcoholic woman, made $3 an hour. I had filed against somebody who was powerful, wealthy, influential, political, very strong, and it just didn't look like we ought to be in the same marriage or lifetime or anything else, let alone in the same courtroom or in the same case. But I just believed, and my sponsors believed, that we were led in that direction. And so I could tell you about a lot of days in my life in these last 22 years. I'll certainly tell you about this one because it was definitely the most profound and powerful day of my life. And that was the day that we went to court. I had never been in a courtroom before. Conway was there testifying to help me get my children back. There were any number of lawyers in the program, and I believe all of them, as of this year, have died. But there were three lawyers in the program who were just there for support. They weren't handling my case. They were just there for support. My own lawyer was in the program. And my sponsors were testifying to help me get my children back. And, you know, they said that I had the vibrations, like Conway talks about. I had the vibrations that day. I was shaking so hard. I was so frightened. And I was on the witness stand for 5 hours, and every gory detail of my alcoholic life came out in that witness stand. But do you know who brought it out? I did. My attorney, who had said, now don't elaborate, just say yes and no and shut up, don't say anything. All of a sudden, he is asking me questions, and I'm just responding to him, telling my story in 5 hours, obviously in greater detail than I can tell you. And it's like Brad and I were just having a little AA meeting right there in the courtroom, and you could have heard a pin drop in that courtroom. Because yes, they did hear the gory details, but they also heard my spiritual recovery. They also heard about my relationship with God. They also heard about my work in Alcoholics Anonymous and what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for me. And you could have heard a pin drop. Those people didn't know about recovery. It was fascinating to them. And, you know, I would realize later that I was so comfortable finally because, you know, by that time I accepted my alcoholism as a gift. It's a gift. And I had done my first step, and I had done my fourth and fifth step. I had a conscious contact with God. I'd made my amends. I tried to practice these principles every day in my program and in my life. There wasn't anything they could ask me that I was afraid to talk about. And I did not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And there wasn't anything they could ask me that I was not willing to tell them. And the truth that you had taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous had completely set me free. I was completely free, free of fear, in the most fearful place I'd ever. Well, my sponsor was testifying to help me get my children back as well. He always said that there was a oneness between me and my children that he had rarely seen between a parent and child. And he thought that we deserved to be together. Now we tend to call that codependence, and we try to get rid of it. But my sponsor thought it was a good thing. It was the most wonderful day of my life, and it was the most traumatic day of my life, all in one. The most wonderful time, the most traumatic time that I've ever lived through before or since. My sponsor testified, and they said, "Mr. Johnson, can you tell us that this woman will be here will be sober next week?" He said, "No, I can't tell you that anybody in this courtroom will be sober next week." He said, "We cannot predict the future." And within a matter of moments, Jimmy Johnson was dead. He got down from the witness stand, and he took his wife, Johnny, outside the courtroom door, and he said, "Honey, if we could have written a script, we could not have written the script that is playing out in that courtroom today." He said, "Honey, I think we have 3 new grandchildren today. Let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate." And those were his last words. He suffered a massive heart attack and he was gone. And ironically, it was the week of the first roundup. And we were all registered to be right here in this room. And we wound up going to his funeral instead. And I felt responsible for his death because I had asked him to testify to help me get my children back. And all of you who knew us were there. It was a powerful Alcoholics Anonymous demonstration because you were all there, if you knew us, holding our hands through that hour of tragedy. And you helped me to understand that I am not God and I don't make those decisions. And a little later, I could appreciate it somewhat differently in that an autopsy showed that Jimmy had terminal cancer. And he would have died a very painful death in a very short period of time. And God did allow him to die in a moment of helping another human being, which was the way he had lived his life, and with a smile on his face, saying, "Let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate." Well, that was the trauma. And the wonderful part of that time was that I was given my children back. When everybody, including my attorney, said that it might not be done. But it was done. And it was done because it was God's will. And I've had the most wonderful family, in spite of how sadistic they are on my birthdays. They are the most wonderful people in their own right. They just, you know, God has raised those children. It has nothing to do with parenting. Obviously, the story I've just told you has nothing to do with parenting. But they are the most wonderful people. And they are just very special, and they have their own wonderful stories. One of my daughters has been sober 3.5 years now, is drug-free 3.5 years. And although she's not in meetings, she talks about it very freely, and I just have to give her and God the right to have their path. And it's not my path. So I just have to practice Al-Anon and let that go. But they are just wonderful people. My son, the oldest one, is just so responsible. You would just know that. He's wonderfully responsible and such a really decent human being. All of my children do a lot of volunteer work, and they do that on their own. They are real givers. And I'm just so proud, and I just love them all so much, and I'm just so proud of them all. I wish I could tell you about their stories, but I can't. That's not my job. So my family life has been absolutely wonderful, you know. What has it been like? I got custody of my children after I'd been sober a while. I was given a job. I was given a little job making $2.45 an hour, making up beds and sweeping floors and talking to people on detox. That was a gift. They just gave me that little job because I didn't have sense enough to come in out of the rain. I just told Conway recently, I just am so grateful nobody died because I was barely out of DTs and there were some other folks there who were still using and... I'm just glad nobody died, that God kept all those people alive back in those days when I was still so sick. I'm so grateful for that little job. I'm so grateful that I started at the very bottom of this field. The number one job of sweeping floors, making up beds, and just sitting and talking to people in detox. I just have such gratitude for that. And, you know, they saw that I had gratitude. They saw that I took pride in that job. And they began to promote me, and they sent me to training, and so I became a counselor, and then they promoted me to follow-up care coordinator, and then to aftercare coordinator. I had the dubious distinction of being the only staff member ever at Peachford Hospital who went from DTs in the detox ward to director of aftercare services. And then I was there for 5 years. It was the best education I've ever had. And then I went to another hospital. And during that time, that hospital paid for me to go to graduate school. And I will tell you, in graduate school, I didn't learn half as much as I had learned in the 5 years I worked at Peachford Hospital and in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had to forget most of what I learned in graduate school. In fact, I was joking with one of my colleagues, social work colleagues, about the exam. And I said, actually, I am so unlike a social worker, which is what my graduate degree is in. I said, I am so unlike a social worker that if I were taking that exam, I would have to think, now what is the right answer? And I would be on the wrong answer. I'd have to pick out what I would think was the wrong answer, and that would turn out to be the right one. That's the way it would be. But they paid for me to go to graduate school, and I went to graduate school because I actually was having a hard time supporting the children financially. And so I went to graduate school, and the very quarter that I graduated, the very month I was receiving my diploma, I was offered a private practice, and I have been blessed with a wonderful private practice ever since 1982 when I graduated. And I have just loved my practice, and I still love my practice. I just have had the best time for these past 16 years. And I love working with people, and I despise working with managed care. And that is just the way it goes. And I don't think it's going to change. I do work on my attitude about that a lot. But I have not seen my attitude changing about that. So I guess God's going to have to get out the 2x4 if I ever change my attitude about that. But I love working with people. And I just get so much energy from watching other people grow. And I know that I can grow when I can watch other people grow. And so I've had the greatest career as a result. It is a gift. It's an absolute gift. You know, that God would have given me, talk about full circles, that God would have given me a disease that I thought took it all away. And in fact, it has given me more than it ever took away. And it has given me more than I ever dreamed in a whole lifetime that I would have. If I had designed my life, I would have sold myself short, because the life that God has designed for me has just been so much more rewarding than anything I could have designed. And I haven't pursued these things. I didn't pursue that private practice. It pursued me. Doctors came to me and asked me to put that together. I didn't pursue that. And that is the story of God doing for me what I could not do for myself, and God bringing me full circle. And, you know, if the career weren't enough, then... In 1984, the governor of Georgia appointed me to the governor's advisory council on mental health. I mean, can you imagine anybody who hid vanilla flavoring in a shoebox being appointed as an advisor to anybody on mental health? Full circle, full circle. Appointed me to the Commission on Drug Awareness and Prevention. You know, same thing. And then, of all the full circles, here I was, arrested. 1973, DUI, DeKalb County, Georgia, said, you can't take me to jail. Like I said, I'm a lady. You know, lady, you're going to jail. And I went to jail. In 1986, the governor of Georgia appointed me the chairperson of the DUI Assessment Task Force. Which included DeKalb County. So, full circle. God just keeps bringing me full circle. Another full circle is the relationship that I have with my ex-husband today. Because it was bitter. There are people in this room who remember how bitter it was. And we have grown up, and we have forgiven each other, and we have a full circle friendship today that is just very rewarding, not only to us, but to our whole family. And we do things as a family all the time. All holidays, all birthdays, we do as a family. And one of the real joys that I had recently was that my children's stepsister, whose mother was not kind to my children, recently married and asked me to be in her family wedding party. And here I'm not even connected to her family, but she had a corsage for me, and she asked me to sit with her family, and she had me at the rehearsal dinner. And that's a real reward, I'll tell you, because I'm not a part of her, technically not a part of her family. But she loves me like a member of her family. It's a real, real reward. I've just had so many full circle rewards. I just have so much gratitude, you know. I've lived the peaks and I have lived the valleys, because that is the way life is. About a month ago, I was beaten up and robbed at gunpoint, which was definitely one of the most traumatic things I've ever experienced. But you know, next month I am going to be able to give my 85-year-old mother a birthday present with a trip to Italy for 2 weeks. Peaks and valleys, because that's the way life is. And I feel a lot of gratitude that God has not asked me to read about life in a book. He has let me experience the peaks and the valleys all along the way. Doesn't mean I want to repeat them all, but I've gotten to experience them, and alcoholism is a gift. It's just a gift. It has given me so much more than it took away. I know what it feels like to have my father say, "Tony, you're a burden to everybody. Why don't you just kill yourself?" But I know what it feels like to have that man live to see me sober. And the last thing he said to me was, "I love you." And I know what it feels like to experience the ultimate degradation for a woman in my day. And that is to be labeled an unfit mother in society and to have my children removed from my care. But I was given my children back. And today, I'm listed in Who's Who of American Women. And there is no... there is no explanation for that. But a loving God who catapulted me against my will into Alcoholics Anonymous with the likes of you. And you helped me grow up and become a responsible woman. And I will be eternally grateful to you. I was always worth something, but it took my friendship and fellowship with you and Alcoholics Anonymous for me to realize that I was worth something. And I am so grateful to you. I want to thank you for this shared journey. It has been a wonderful 23 years, and I have such gratitude for the 23 years and for you. And thanks for letting me be with you.